Good morning, New Mexico, and welcome to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. We are broadcasting live from the Santa Fe Baking Company on Cordova Road and streaming on the web at ksfr.org. We are also podcasting. The website is santafe.radiocafe.org, where you can listen to the show anytime you want, thanks to Santa Fe's .foil computer services. You can also subscribe to the show on iTunes. This is the third day of our featuring of the Santa Fe Film Festival in its many manifestations, and we're talking about all sorts of different films today. I'd like to introduce right now by telephone Matthew Bardos. He's the producer, editor, and director of a film called Off the Rocker, which is screaming at the Indian Arts Museum on Thursday. That's tomorrow at 9:15 in the morning and again on Saturday afternoon at 4 o'clock. Welcome, Matthew.
Hi, thanks for having me on the show. I appreciate it.
This is an amusing film, among other things, about a group of senior citizens living in Las Vegas, not New Mexico, Las Vegas, Nevada, who seem to have a common interest of dancing the night away. How did you come to make this film?
Basically, I found the story. My wife, who was the co-producer in the film, was friends with the main subject, Annette DiStefano. She was friends with her and her wife, her and her husband, and we went to Vegas one time for my wife's work, and she had suggested that I should have dinner with her and her husband and their friends. And what I thought was going to be an hour-long dinner ended up being a three-hour-long dinner with the main. I interview a group of about 10 of these couples in the film, of a main group of about 300, and it ended up being about a three-hour-long dinner of this, you know, group of friends going on and on about their active lifestyle and the communal atmosphere of these dances, and then also how their activity level carries over into the other aspects of their life, getting up at 4:30 every morning and running and swimming and lifting weights and being in the gym. And then also the activities that they carry on through the day, this you know, very hyperactive lifestyle that they lead in their age group, which generally is between about 75 to 95 years old.
Well, and romance abounds as if it were a college dormitory.
Yeah, I mean, it's very, you know, that's one of the aspects of the film that I really wanted them, you know, to tell, is that it's, you know, I think society tends to put a taboo on senior sexuality. And, you know, that was one thing that they were very forward about. You know, I really didn't have to do very much prodding with that in terms of the questioning. They were very open about, you know, their sexuality, and it's a very natural thing for them, as it is with, you know, middle-aged people and younger people. And, you know, there's a section of the film where they're very open about that. And it's, you know, it's very natural. It's very important for them that exists, and it exists in many forms. It's, you know, everything from one night stands to marriage. You know, it exists in many forms the same way that it does in you know, younger couples. And
including,
for me, that was
including that guy who married the woman because of her spaghetti and meatballs.
There was that couple. There's a couple that in the marriage segment where you know, it's funny because that's one thing. It's another whole side of the film where I discuss, you know, the aspect of relationships and how that takes many forms in that age group. Everything from, you know, just dating, people who just want to be single, you know, all the way up to seniors who marry three or four times in that age group. It's about companionship and about, you know, wanting to find, you know, what happens, the ramifications of what it's like when you're married to somebody for 20 or 30 years and then your spouse dies. What do you do, you know, when that happens? And you find that in this film. You find that, you know, you have that, you go through that experience with people in this film. And that's one of the great ways that I think anyone who watches the film can connect with it, because either you're preparing to be that, you know, the age that these people are, or you have a parent that is this active, or you wish were this active, or, you know, you know somebody that is, you know, this age, or you are this age. you know.
Well, there's a one thing I noticed. There's a conspicuous absence of anybody who's even remotely young, any kind of intergenerational communication, children, anything like that. It's very much of a self-contained enclave of senior citizens.
Yeah, that's part of the aspect of the community that they live in, Sun City, Summerlin, there in Summerlin, Nevada, which is just it's a suburb outside of Las Vegas. I think they have a minimum age requirement of 55 or something like that. And so they, you know, that's fairly exclusive to the sort of lifestyle that they lead. But as you see in the film, that's not really a handicap. You know, they have everything from softball leagues and you know, bowling leagues, you know, all the way up to, you know, these dances where it's not as if there's buses taking these seniors to the dances. They're fiercely independent. There's a matter of fact, when I went back for the world premiere in of the film in July, Dave Rifkin, who's one of the subjects of the film, he's 80. No, I'm sorry, he'll be 90 years. He's 90 years old. He just bought a new car, and he's already gotten a speeding ticket. You know, so he's. You know, on his way to a dance. So they're fiercely independent. And that's what's so inspiring about the film is that what can be taken from it is just learning, you know, learning how to be active from you know, their active lifestyle. And it's just fascinating and very humorous to watch their, you know, their activity level and taking from that.
The film is called Off the Rocker, and Matthew Bardoz is the producer, editor, and director. Also did a lot of the music in the film, and the film is screening as part of the Santa Fe Film Festival tomorrow, Thursday, at the Indian Arts Museum. I think it's the Museum of Indian Arts and Culture, at 9:15 in the morning, and then again on Saturday in the same location at 4 in the afternoon. Matthew Bardoz, thanks so much for being with us here on the Santa Fe Radio Cafe.
Thanks so much for having me, and I look forward to seeing everybody in Santa Fe.
We look forward to that, too. And right now, sitting at the table with us, we are moving on to talk about a film, well, actually a number of films. There's a film called Making Trouble, which is produced by Gail Reamer, who is sitting with us here right now. And Aviva Weintraub is with us, and Gabriella Boehm is with us. She is a filmmaker who's made a film called The Longing, The Forgotten Jews of South America. Welcome, ladies, to the Radio Cafe.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
So there's a lot going on. First of all, the Jewish Film Festival is now part of the Santa Fe Film Festival.
Yes, I work at the Jewish Museum in New York, and we co-present the New York Jewish Film Festival annually in January with the Film Society of Lincoln Center, and we're thrilled to bring a package of films here to the Santa Fe Film Festival.
And one of the films is called Making Trouble, and you, Gail Reamer, are the producer of that film. Tell us about this film. I watched it last night. It is hilarious. It's a film about several generations of Jewish women comedians.
Well, the film was actually produced by the Jewish Women's Archive. I'm the executive producer. I'm also the founding director of the archive. Our goal at the archive is to collect, gather, record, and tell the stories of Jewish women. This is our first foray into film, and it's obviously teaching us a big lesson about why film is a great medium for telling stories. It's also, well, it's not exactly our first foray into comedy, but one of the things that we have felt for a long time is people think archive, they think very serious, and history is filled with funny women as well, funny Jewish women. When we think about the history of Jewish comedy, we rarely think of the women, which is exactly why the archive was founded, to fill in those stories where Jewish women are missing. Women are missing in most stories. This particular one has been a lot of fun to do, and we've learned a lot in the process, and I think people are learning a lot in the process from all generations. Young people have never heard of Sophie Tucker, and they're blown away by her brassiness, by her challenge of conventions. People my age just, you know, love seeing Gilda Radner again on the screen.
Now, I've heard of Sophie Tucker, but I've never heard of Molly Picon.
Well, Molly Picon is probably the least known because most of her work was done in Yiddish theater, though you're probably too young to remember. She actually did, at the end of her career, she was on Gomer Pyle. So she did have a brief television presence, though she's really not a television personality. She's a stage personality and was really the darling of Yiddish theater and also Yiddish film. The film that is featured in our film, or that we have the most clips from, is a film called Yiddle Mit and Fiddle, Yiddle with the Fiddle. Molly Picon plays, she was in her late 30s at that time, and she plays a young girl who dresses up as a little boy and goes on the road with her father. Again, defying every convention about what women were supposed to do, about what Jewish women were supposed to do.
So it's interesting to be running an archive, because an archive is full of material, but if it doesn't get seen, then what good is it? Here you are showing it to the public. But it's also a huge job to go in and start selecting what you are going to show and what you're going to edit out.
It is a huge job, and the film took us much longer than we expected. But I should just clarify that, in a sense, these women mirror who we are as an archive. We're a very unconventional archive. We are not a physical repository. We live on the internet at www.jwa.org. We don't own any materials. All the materials that we have reside in other repositories. And even for the film, we worked with lots of repositories to gather the footage and the clips and the photos.
Very interesting. That's the archive of the future.
It is the art. We call ourselves an archive for the 21st century, recognizing how people will be accessing information and how they are accessing information already.
I think there are some very interesting things that come up in the film. And one is that a number of these Jewish comedians, female comedians, were completely unrepressed about talking about sexuality, and that created quite a scandal, especially depending on what audience they were speaking to.
Absolutely. We didn't actually, the women in the film were not as scandalous. There were women who were more scandalous. Belle Barth, for example,
and you didn't
who was
show
frequently
them to us?
Arrested. You know, like any film, any documentary film needs to make choices, and we really wanted to make choices about the women who were pioneers and trailblazing. And one of the ways in which they were trailblazing was to talk about sexuality openly. And in some ways, again, Sophie Tucker is really, this is what surprises so many people, how open she was about women's sexual needs, women's sexual desires, and how funny she was about it.
There's also a character named Fanny Bryce, whom I was not familiar with either.
Really? So Fanny Bryce is actually the one that most people, if they know anything about Jewish women in film, are familiar with through Barbra Streisand, through Funny Girl, because Fanny Bryce is the character that Funny Girl is about. But maybe that's also before your time. And what Fanny Bryce was able to do that she was really the first one to do, is to just play the funny woman on stage and not be embarrassed about being silly, about being funny.
Somebody said she may not be the prettiest girl on stage, but she's definitely the funniest girl on stage.
Well, she definitely was not, by conventional standards, the prettiest, and that was one of the problems that Ziegfeld had with her, that she just didn't fit that conventional mode. And I think a lot of the Fanny section actually focuses on the way in which she didn't fit a conventional mode. So she just said, so what? I can be funny, and I'll be who I am.
And I can be much more than exactly. A pretty face on stage that looks like everybody else.
Exactly. Exactly.
So Joan Rivers is another character, and I've everybody's seen probably some of Joan Rivers' work, but this movie leaves you wanting to see a whole lot more of it, because she really is funny, but she also is somebody who was supposed to marry a doctor and raise kids and have a nice suburban life, and she just couldn't do it. She didn't have it in her.
Right. Joan Rivers, she tried. I mean,
she did try.
She went to Barnard, and she got married to a doctor, and it just didn't work for her, as she says in the film. A lot of people have the same reaction as you're having to Joan Rivers in this film. I think that Joan comes out fabulously. I think bringing her back to her roots when she was working with Treva Silverman was a brilliant idea on the part of the director.
Tell us who Treva Silverman is.
Treva Silverman was writing. She was a comedy writer and was writing a lot of Joan's lines for her, helping Joan write those lines. Then Treva had her own career in comedy and on television.
And was an executive with the Mary Tyler Moore Show.
Exactly. And has gone off and had her own career. But bringing them back together, I think, was a brilliant stroke, and brings Joan Rivers out in this wonderful way and brings her back to her really early roots.
And then there's Gilda Radner, who made her fame on Saturday Night Live, who died very young. But there's an amazing scene from Saturday Night Live where she is doing a sketch in which she shows her waspy neighbors what a menorah is.
Yeah, it's one of my favorite pieces in the film. I actually don't want to give away the punchline of that because I think people will just enjoy it when they see it. But Jackie Hoffman, who comments on that scene in the film, talks about how important it was to see a Jewish woman light a menorah on television, to see herself and her own tradition reflected on television. We just get saturated by Christmas and don't see anything, Jews don't see anything that relates to their tradition, and suddenly to see Gilda Radner on Saturday Night Live lighting that menorah, and it wasn't just Jackie Hoffman who was moved by that. It was a tremendously moving moment for a lot of Jewish people.
Yeah, and somebody compared it to, I can't remember which black actor said it was like the first time they ever saw the black person on the Starship Enterprise on Star Trek.
That's right.
So we should tell our listeners that Making Trouble screens tonight at Tipton Hall at 8 in the evening, but the advance tickets are sold out, and any seats not claimed by pass holders will be sold at the door tonight. If you miss it tonight, because it probably will be sold out, not everybody who wants to see it will be able to, it also screens on Sunday at 10:15 in the morning at Tipton Hall, which is on the College of Santa Fe campus. Finally, Wendy Wasserstein, playwright, very well known, well recognized, but it was interesting to find out that when she went to Yale Drama School, people really almost weren't ready for dramas about women's friendships and things that we kind of take for granted now.
I think there are two reasons. Many people ask us, why is Wendy in this film? I mean, she's not your standard comedian, but we did want a broader sense of what constitutes comedy and ways in which Jewish women are funny. The other reason that Wendy is in this film is, you know, with Sarah Silverman and lots of other comedians who have a wide audience today, people often say, what do you mean Jewish women in comedy are not known? And I think what is critical about that Wendy section is it reminds people of how relatively recent it is that women were accepted in these fields, what it took for them, the challenges they had to make it.
I think the last 20 years, which is, I mean, schools like Yale had been co-educational for some time, but the changes for women in the last 20 years have been enormous, and this section on Wendy Wasserstein really highlights that.
Exactly. And it's important to remember, we think it's important to remember how relatively recent these gains are, because that also reminds us how fragile they are and how important it is for us to keep talking about them.
And there's some great footage of the very young Meryl Streep in that section in a play of Wendy Wasserstein.
That's right. There's a section from Uncommon Women. A lot of people are surprised to see Meryl Streep in that play, and Meryl Streep was at Yale Drama School.
At Yale Drama School, exactly. We're talking to Gail Reamer, who is the director of the Jewish Women's Archive and the executive producer of the film Making Trouble. Well, there's much more to talk about, but let's turn right now to Gabriela Böhm, who has made a film called The Longing, The Forgotten Jews of South America.
Hi, good morning.
Good morning. It's wonderful to have you here. It's a surprise visit on your part, so I haven't seen the film yet. Tell us about it.
Well, the film is about the descendants of those who were forced to convert to Catholicism during the Inquisition in Spain and Portugal. And many generations later, they found themselves in South America, and they find that they have they have a feeling, they have a notion, they have some sort of clue that they were Jews in the past, and so they are trying to reclaim back their Judaism by converting back to Judaism. Now, they live in, the ones that I follow, they live in Ecuador and Colombia, and so they are in the process of conversion by the Reform movement, and the communities in those locales are very much not accepting them and not allowing them in, and they have, there's a...
Why on earth not?
Well, it's a very complicated question, but I think that the, I bring it up in the movie, and the, one of the elements is that the communities in those places are very, very small, and they are consist mostly of Ashkenazi Jews who were who are immigrants from Eastern Europe post World War II, and they themselves are they form a sort of club association in some ways, and they have a sense of isolation and the need to defend themselves against those who are different. And so whether it is because of the Reform movement versus the Orthodox movement, or whether it is because their skin color is different, or whether because they're a different class, they feel that they are not, they do not want others who are different to come in.
How did you come onto this topic? How did you decide to make the film?
Well, it started many years ago when I actually heard about the Crypto Jews of New Mexico.
Oh, okay.
I don't know if you remember that NPR show.
Well, yeah, no, it's something we've talked about on this show, and it's a subject that's talked about more over the last probably 10 or 15 years in New Mexico than it has before.
Right. It is... It was a very interesting program at the time, and I came down to New Mexico, and I tried to make a film about the Crypto Jews of New Mexico, but at the time I was a film student at NYU, and I wasn't really ready to tackle such a big project. And many, many years later, I that idea of duality, of dual living, of having to be one thing on the outside and another on the inside, really steered me, and it felt that it was something that I connected in some way, and I wanted to do it, and I began to research about the South American crypto Jews or South American conversos. There's different names for these people.
And you are yourself from South America?
I am Argentinian by birth, yes, and but my parents both are from Eastern Europe. They're both Holocaust survivors who arrived to South America after the war.
And so, is this a part of your own family history?
No, I'm not a crypto Jew.
Okay.
No, a crypto is a strange word. It is a scientific new word that has come out. It means like hidden.
Hidden.
But really, it's a strange word. I don't know if I like it that much. But no, I'm Ashkenazi Jew. I connect to the question of having to be one thing on the inside and another on the outside. In some ways, being a Holocaust, a descendant of Holocaust survivors, have somehow instilled within me a sense of, I guess it's a survival mechanism and being a little different and having to figure out how the world works in within me and in the actuality. And so, and living in Argentina in the Jewish community had also brought back those issues for me. And so I connected to their quest, and I connected to their sense of longing to connect.
Now, how has the reception been for this film in South America, the Jewish community?
And I have not shown it in South America yet.
Oh, okay.
It premiered at the New York Jewish Film Festival last January, and it has shown at many festivals around the country, and as well as in Israel and in Canada. I'm still in the process of moving the film to South America. It hasn't happened yet, but it hopefully will. It has received a great response from people in when I screen it. People do feel that there is a there's a lot of issues that the film brings up for the Jewish community that need to be addressed. And so I think it is it's an important question to know how to bring in these people who are different from us, or the norm Jewish people, so to speak.
And now, you showed the film yesterday here in Santa Fe.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And it's screening again on Friday at 10:45 in the morning at the New Mexico Film Museum, which is the former Jean Cocteau Theater. Let's talk about the Jewish Film Festival, some of the other films of Aviva Weintraub. What are some of your other favorites that are screening here in Santa Fe?
Well, we were thrilled last night to present My Mexican Shiva, which is a new film from Alejandro Springall. It's a Mexican production. It's a comedy based on a novella by the writer Ilan Stavans. It's only the second feature film to come out of Mexico that has a Jewish subject matter, and it's the first narrative and definitely the first comedy. And I think audiences...
Is it going to be shown again?
Much. It is. I don't know the schedule. But
okay. Ladies and gentlemen, there is a website called SantaFeFilmFestival.com, and you can find out in there. And also, you can go to the Film Center on St. Michael's Drive, and the program books, which are beautiful this year, will have all that information in it. What are some of your others?
Well, we have two screenings today. We have a documentary at 3 o'clock called Toots, which is about the legendary restaurateur and nightclub owner Toots Shore. He was active in New York City, and this is a very loving and yet not entirely nostalgic or sentimental documentary produced by his granddaughter, Christy Jacobson. And it really shows Toots's all aspects of his troubled personality and his charisma. He was tough, he was tender, he was interesting, and he had a very, very interesting life in New York.
And that's today at 3 o'clock at the Santa Fe Film Center, and then again tomorrow morning at 10:45 at the New Mexico Film Museum. It's unfortunately time to go, but I want to thank you all so much for being with us here on the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. Gabriela Boehm is the filmmaker whose film is called The Longing, The Forgotten Jews of South America. Aviva Weintraub is with the New York Jewish Film Festival, and that's part of the Jewish Museum in New York City. And Gail Reamer is executive director of the Jewish Women's Archive and producer of Making Trouble. So, ladies, let's go out and make more trouble for the rest of the day. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
We're going to take a little break right now, and when we come back, we'll be talking about Broke Sky. Welcome to, stay tuned to KSFR. I'd like now to welcome, joining us by telephone, Tom Calloway. He's the director and writer of a film called Broke Sky, which screens on Friday and Sunday at the De Vargas 2, both times at 3 o'clock. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Hi.
This is a.
I hope you can hear me. I got a pretty bad perception here.
We can hear you fine. I guess you're in the middle of the desert in California making another film right now.
Yes, I am.
So we're very glad to have you. This is a film about two Texas animal control officers, Earl and Bucky, who drive around together picking up roadkill. One day they pick up a hitchhiker, and soon after that they find her body, and things heat up from there. What was the inspiration for this film? How'd you come up with this story?
Actually, a couple of writers, or one writer from New Mexico, actually wrote the original screenplay, a guy named Scott Phillips. And I basically got that idea, and we kind of just changed it up a little bit. And it just kind of reminded me of my life in Texas, in a way.
And now you are from Texas, and in fact, it was filmed pretty close to where you were raised. Is that true?
Yeah, I grew up in Waco, Texas, and we shot in Waco and like a lot of little small towns, Moody, Texas, and McGregor. All the little towns are outside of Waco.
It's a very funny film, and at the same time, it's very dark. It's an unusual combination, and hard to pull off. You, as you're watching it at the beginning, you think this is going to be light, and it takes you down to a pretty deep place. How do you control those shifts of mood or sort of simultaneously occurring moods?
Well, that was the hardest part, and I was really worried whether it was going to come off because I didn't want to make light of what you find out in the movie. But I like the idea of starting out one way and then suddenly taking a turn, just like, you know, people's lives do, you know, how you think it's one way and then it just goes completely the opposite.
So this film was shot over 4 years. which I found amazing. I mean, I'm glad I didn't know that when I was watching the screener, because it didn't show, but I would think that it's a little scary to do that because, you know, people age, their hair's style changes. I mean, how did you pull this off?
Well, it wasn't easy. I mean, it was very difficult, actually, and we lucked out in a lot of ways. I mean, I had to shoot it because I financed it myself for the most part, and I had to shoot it in Texas around the availability of the actors and my family, basically, and crew members that we could bring together, and usually in the summer. So it was very difficult. We did have some weight loss and gain. Some of the actors, you don't really notice, and, you know, Earl's hair goes a little grayer than it was at the beginning, so that was a little difficult, but we had, you know, hair, makeup people to kind of fix that.
And so you financed the whole thing yourself? Are you there?
Yeah, I'm here. Sorry. You're starting up a wind machine behind me here.
Oh, okay. You financed the whole movie out of your own pocket?
About 80% of it. And then I had a little bit of a couple investors, some family and some friends.
That's amazing, because the production values on it are very strong.
Oh, thank you.
Tell us about the actors. How did you put the cast together?
Just a few months before we started, I saw a picture called Together and Alone, and that starred the Earl character, Joe Unger. And he was just perfect. I just knew I had to have him in the movie. And luckily, he was at the screening, so I just talked to him, met him there, and then we just hooked up. And then the Will Wallace character is a guy that, strangely enough, I'd been recommended. Several people had recommended me or him to me on numerous occasions, and then we just happened to meet up, and so he came in, auditioned, and that worked out. And then the rest of the cast were people, for the most part, that I've actually worked with, like Bruce Glover and Dwayne Whitaker and Marco Perella, those guys I'd all worked with when, as a DP.
Tell us about your own background. Is this the first feature that you've written and directed?
Yeah, and I didn't write the whole thing. It was written
right.
by several people. But, it's the first one I directed. I've been a DP for a long time, about 18 years, and I've shot probably 60 or 70 movies. And I've directed some second unit, a lot of mostly just action stuff, but I just wanted to always make my own film. And decided the only way I was going to make it is if I financed it myself. So I did that, and that's how the other reason it took so long. I would have to shoot a couple of movies to make some money to pay for the production.
This is a... you know, a thriller, and it's really as good as anything out there, and I hope it will have theatrical distribution. What kind of distribution have you had so far?
Well, nothing so far. We're hoping to hit the festivals and get something out of it. You know, hopefully somebody will find it or see it and want to put it out. I mean, that's the... I've been working so much since we finished it, to finish paying for it, that I haven't really had that much time to go after the distributors, but we're just now starting to.
So what is it like to be an independent filmmaker on a film like this? I mean, it was interesting. We talked yesterday to a filmmaker who shot on a very low budget, shot the whole film in 18 days. That's one way to do it. This, over 4 years, I mean, why did it take so long?
Because I really didn't have all the money together. It was, you know, sort of opportunities we had to shoot, and... just kind of the way it worked out. I mean, I did a lot of stuff. There's tons of stuff in the movie. I've seen it, like all the transitional stuff. I just shot myself. It was just me and maybe a couple of kids from high school that were back in Texas. And then, you know, the actual principal that we, photographer that we shot with the actors, we did it three different times. Once for like 18 days, and we did like 5 days, and then we did another like 3 day. So it wasn't that many days. It was just that the actor availability, and almost the only way we could pull it off.
So there is, ladies and gentlemen, more than your average amount of roadkill in this movie. I assume no animals were harmed in the making of this film. But how did you...
That is correct.
How did you do it? I mean, did you work with the animal control people of Waco?
Well, no. In Texas, there's an incredible amount of natural roadkill. And a lot of it is real stuff that we photographed alongside the roads. And then we made stuff that the actors had to deal with. For the most part, we made some... fake roadkill.
And there's the houses, the locations. Again, how did you come up with these? Were these people whom you knew?
No, actually, some of it was just, we'd drive around in, like, the Rufus house, which is a great house. We're just driving down the road, and I saw it, and it's, like, this really old house built in, like, 1907. It's kind of leaning to the right. Looks like it's about to fall down.
Right.
And we just went in there and talked to the guy, and he can use it. I mean, all the locations were free. You know, the whole place, everybody was really friendly. They closed down shops for us. They gave us free food. It was just, you know, the community just really took us under their wing and let us do whatever we wanted.
And have you shown the film in Waco?
I'm going to in January. I'm going to have a kind of a premiere there and a big party for everybody.
Well, the film is, I think, terrific. It's one of my, I would say it's one of my top three picks of the festival. It's called Broke Sky, directed and co-written by Tom Calloway. Are you going to be here for the festival at all?
I'm going to try to. I'm working. It all depends. We've had some weather issues here, so I'm not sure if I'm going to be able to make it, but I'm going to try to make it for Sunday.
Are you working on any other films of your own these days?
No, I'm trying to put together one right now, as a matter of fact, but I don't have anything definite.
Well, we look forward to seeing you here and to seeing your work in the future. Tom Calloway, his film is called Broke Sky, and it screens on Friday and Sunday at 3 o'clock at the DeVargas 2, part of the Santa Fe Film Festival. We're going to take another little break right now. We'll be right back. Stay tuned to KSFR. Hello?
Hello, Mary Charlotte.
Okay. Are you there?
I am. Can you hear me?
Yes.
Hi there. Good morning.
Excellent. Good morning. Wonderful to have you here. This is a very funny film about a Southern Christian family in which mom, dad, and the two kids have a car accident. Three of them die, go to heaven, or limbo perhaps, meet Jesus, get sent back to earth to keep living, and they live quite differently. What is the inspiration for the movie?
Well, growing up in the South sort of inspires every Southern filmmaker.
Where are you from?
I'm from Greensboro, North Carolina, and I shot part of the movie there. It's actually going to be opening, making its theatrical debut in December there. Be very interesting to see how the community there responds to it. The inspiration for the film comes from growing up in a very, very religion-driven town, very Southern Baptist, and stepping back and looking at it and going, wait a minute, I'm being sold something and I'm not sure why. And I don't know why I have to be so ashamed of myself if I don't buy it hook, line, and sinker. That's kind of where it came from, I imagine.
Did your family, quote-unquote, buy into this, into the type of religion that was all around you?
Well, here's the thing. You know, we were surrounded by Southern Baptists, and so we also were going to be good Southern Baptists. And my father was a Sunday school teacher, and when I was around the age of six, I have very little recollection of this, the head of the church came to him because he would make his kids laugh during class, and they came to him and said, a place of God is no place for laughter.
Uh-oh.
And my father said, well, then it's no place for me and my family, and we left and never went back. So I was allowed to observe this behavior. I wasn't as indoctrinated as the people around me probably were.
Is that really the ethos of the Southern Baptist Church, that laughing is a bad thing?
Oh, laughing, dancing, you name it. I mean, there's an old joke about why Southern Baptists don't have sex standing up.
Because it might lead to dancing.
People think they're dancing.
Yes, we've heard this joke. But the film is so funny that, as I told you in email the other day, I was watching it with my very proper mother.
You don't know Mary Charlotte? That kills me, by the way.
Well, I would think everybody would find it funny, no matter what their age, religion, or demographic, unless they were exactly the people who were being made fun of.
You know, okay, here's something interesting. When it premiered at Sundance, right before that, my family saw it, and I had one sister who didn't talk to me for 3 months.
No.
Afterwards. Yeah. And she said that she found it too autobiographical, and it's really, it's not. I mean, the father's a lawyer, and my father's a lawyer. The family's Southern, and we're Southern, but that's about it. You know, and there have been a few people, like after Sundance, I started looking into blogs and seeing what sort of chatter might exist out there about the movie. And most people totally got it and embraced it and was glad it was bringing up the conversation about how religion instills shame in you that you don't even know you have. And but there were some people, and they were very far right on the religious spectrum, I imagine, who just decided to call the film pornographic and leave it at that, and they hated it. And I found that response really interesting. I'm still very, very fascinated by the different ways people respond to this story.
It sort of, it has the makings of a cult classic. It's one of those things that you could, you know, watch and show it to your friends and take it to people for the midnight showing and so on. How did you go about financing it? I mean, it's your classic independent film.
It's as independent as you get. I work in the film industry in Los Angeles, and I do legal stuff on films. I do clearances. It's too boring to talk about on the radio. Your drivers will just drive off the road. People are always saying to me, "Oh, that sounds fascinating," and I think, "Oh, you sound polite."
Right.
But that's what I do for a living. And I had I came out here. I started making movies when I was 13, and I went to NYU Film School. I came out here to make movies, and I've worked in all sorts of areas in the film industry. And it comes a time when you're, in your late 30s, which I was when I started this project, you got to do what you came here to do. And
yep.
So rather than trying to buy a house, which, is, in L.A., I could spend $1 million for a small patch of grass.
Right.
I decided to take my savings and put it into this movie because that's what I want to do. And I didn't get a crew involved. I did everything myself because when you bring people on set as a favor, it changes the flavor of the set completely. People are disgruntled. People resent being there. And I thought, I don't want that on set. I know how to do all this. I've worked in every department on a film set you possibly could. So that's how I proceeded.
Well, did you know how to do it? I mean, we just before you were on the air, we had somebody on who directed a movie, but he's been a DP for much of his career. And
right.
So the photographer, but I mean, if the main thing you've done is clearances, I mean, how did you figure out how to?
Well, when I was 13, I had a Super 8 camera in my hand. And I found out when I got to film school that we were called Super 8 brats.
Uh-huh.
Because during a very formative period of our lives, we had a camera in our hands, and you're learning more at that time in your life than you probably learn for the rest of your life. And it becomes something very innate in you when you start very young. And in school we covered the technical stuff about lighting and so on. And also, Mary Charlotte, I decided I knew I wasn't going to try to make a movie that looked like a Hollywood movie. That wasn't
right.
The point. The point was to tell a story that a Hollywood movie would never tell, because I'm so bored with commercial cinema these days. One or two movies a year are at all satisfying to me when I go to the movie theater. And so I wanted to make
right.
a movie for those of us who don't need a committee to dumb down a script enough so that everyone will get it. I don't need my entertainment to also be geared for 18-year-old boys,
Although I think probably many 18-year-old boys would be just fine with this film.
Well, because of the, they will be, I imagine, somewhat horrified and titillated by the sexuality expressed in it.
Right.
I don't know if the subject itself will go over their heads or not. What you said about your mom absolutely slays me. I have found that women over the age of 70 respond very strongly to the movie in a very positive way.
That's so interesting.
Which kills me. I mean, I had no idea there was a target market, the 70-year-old woman who basically, and immediately it made sense to me. I just hadn't thought about it in advance. I was like, well, they grew up in a very repressed time, and this movie is about what would happen if you lived free of repression.
Well, and also, I mean, in our particular case, my mother is very interested in religion, and she was saying, even the next day, she said, this makes some very interesting points about some of the problems with these kinds of religions, and sort of took it seriously. I mean, the comedy was the lesser part of it, so it's, I think people can get a lot of different things out of this film. What was the look that you were looking for? You said you didn't want it to look like your typical Hollywood movie.
Well, I knew that I couldn't have swooping crane shots and shots from helicopters and, giant dolly shots that chase people around tracks. I decided since I decided not to try to do anything that I would end up doing poorly, but the look itself was supposed to be sort of storybook. It's a very colorful movie. Somebody said to me once, it's so colorful. Why did you choose that? And I'm like, well, if you're depicting Southern culture is very colorful, both figuratively and literally. I mean, you have never seen so many people dress in primary colors as you have in North Carolina. It's a very, very colorful place, literally. And that's, you know, I wanted it to look sort of like a Norman Rockwell painting, you know.
Ah, very interesting. Well, let's talk about the cast. New Mexico's own Aviva is the is one of the stars of it. In fact, she's the very confused teenage girl who was not taken to heaven and redeposited on planet Earth, and she has no idea what's happened to her family.
That Aviva, I'll tell you, she was. I did not know her. I was casting the movie, and a friend of mine was walking down the street with her, and I ran into them, and I knew she was Caroline. I psychically or whatever knew that this person was Caroline. And I was trying to be cordial and meet this person, but without like suddenly wanting something from them, which is
right.
Obnoxious. And she says to this day, yeah, he just kept staring at me. And I was like, yeah, because you were my character. I said, okay, I'm sorry. I have this part. Would you read it? And she said, sure. And she came to a table reading and there was no question that this was the right person, and she was absolutely delightful to work with.
Tell us about some of the other cast members. Are they all from L.A.? Are they all actors who are working in Los Angeles?
Yes, all of them are. The lady, Teresa Willis, who plays Betty Franklin, the mom in the family, she's from Kentucky and has been a friend of mine for 20 years here, and since the role called for so much nudity, I was really worried about that. I had Teresa come and read it during the table reading that I had, and I had not offered her the part yet because I didn't know how to ask my friend to be naked for me. It seemed distinctly an unsouthern thing to do. At the end of the reading, I said, would you be, and she said, oh, absolutely. And I realized, oh, that's right, my friend Teresa is practically a nudist.
It's funny. It's like it almost surprised me when you say that there's a lot of nudity in the movie. It doesn't really come off that way because it's so innocent.
It's not supposed to be sexually titillating.
Right. It's very innocent.
Yeah, that's the point. You know, these people have had original sin removed from them.
Right.
And one of the first things that would probably go was remembering to dress.
Exactly. So she plays Betty Franklin, and then Father Franklin is
Robertson Dean.
Played
Frank Franklin, and there were two roles that were cast from the gym that I go to, and I had known Rob Dean peripherally from the gym, just sort of a hi relationship, you know, for years. And once again, I just remembered him when I looked at him, and I thought, oh, you're Frank, and he read it and was delighted to do it. The other person that I met there, I was on the treadmill one day, and there was this guy I'd seen around the gym forever. His name is Pop Da Silva, and he ended up playing Jesus in the movie.
Ah, right.
Yeah, sort of a radical, sort of Rasta-type, light-skinned, mulatto, I'm not exactly sure his entire lineage, distinctly not a white guy, with tattoos up to his shoulders and, you know, great hair.
And, well, I thought you were probably casting for an ethnically correct Jesus.
I was trying to cast away from the Jesus of Redondo Beach that everyone is so fond of looking at here.
The blue-eyed.
Yeah, who didn't live anywhere in that region, thank you. You know, and I was on the treadmill one day, and I looked over, and I just thought, oh, Jesus Christ!
So to speak.
That's my Jesus! You know, and sure enough, he was totally game for it. He's sort of a musician, very easy to get along with.
Well, Jay Floyd, I want to congratulate you on this terrific film, Forgiving the Franklins, and encourage people to go tonight at 7 o'clock at the Armory for the Arts. Aviva will be there. She was supposed to be here today, but she is actually auditioning for another film, so couldn't be here, but she will be here in the evening. And will you be here as well?
I will not be able to make it, and I'm sort of crushed.
Well, we hope to see you another time and wish you the best of luck with this film, Forgiving the Franklins. Jay Floyd, writer and director, thanks again.
Mary Charlotte, thank you.
You've been listening to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte, and all this week we are talking about the Santa Fe Film Festival. We've got 5 films featured tomorrow and a bunch more New Mexico shorts on Friday, so it's just a cavalcade of filmmakers with the Santa Fe Film Festival. You can check out the film festival on the web at santafefilmfestival.com. You can also stop by the Film Center on St. Michael's Drive, the former Cinema Cafe. And you can also check out the box office, which is, well, you better let's see, go to the SantaFeFilmFestival.com, and they will give you the address. I'm not sure where the box office is this year. Anyway, we are podcasting at SantaFeRadioCafe.org, where you can hear the show anytime you want to listen, thanks to Santa Fe's .foil computer services. We are streaming live on the web 24/7 at KSFR.org. You can email me at RadioCafe@KSFR.org. You can leave a message at 428-1528. Thanks to Laurel Reynolds for engineering today. Stay tuned for the BBC, followed by local news by KSFR's award-winning news team. And after that, Good Morning Jazz with John Greenspan will present a number of great jazz vocalists. And Giants of Jazz features vocalist Sarah Vaughan in the first hour and pianist Mulgrew Miller in the second. Broadcasting live from the Santa Fe Baking Company, my name is Mary Charlotte. Have a wonderful day. We'll see you tomorrow. Ciao.